Chapter 16. When his knock gets no response, Byron leaves the porch and goes around the house and enters the small, enclosed backyard. He sees the chair at once beneath the mulberry tree. It's a canvas deck chair, mended and faded and sagged so long to the shape of Hightower's body that even when empty it seems to hold still in ghostly embrace the owner's obese shapelessness. Approaching, Byron thinks how the mute chair, evocative of disuse and supineness and shabby remoteness from the world, is somehow the symbol, and the being, too, of the man himself. "That I am going to disturb again," he thinks, with that faint lift of lip, thinking, "Again? The disturbing I have done him, even he will see that that disturbing is nothing now. And on Sunday again. But then I reckon Sunday would want to take revenge on him too, being as Sunday was invented by folks." He comes up behind the chair and looks down into it. Hightower is asleep. Upon the swell of his paunch where the white shirt, it's a clean and fresh one now, balloons out of the worn black trousers, an open book lies face down. Upon the book, Hightower's hands are folded, peaceful, benignant, almost pontifical. The shirt is made after an old fashion, with a pleated, though carelessly ironed bosom, and he wears no collar. His mouth is open, the loose and flabby flesh sagging away from the round orifice in which the stained lower teeth show, and from the still fine nose, which alone age, the defeat of sheer years, hasn't changed. Looking down at the unconscious face, it seems to Byron as though the whole man were fleeing away from the nose, which holds invincibly to something yet of pride and courage above the sluttishness of vanquishment, like a forgotten flag above a ruined fortress. Again light, the reflection of sky beyond the mulberry leaves, glints and glares upon the spectacle lenses, so that Byron can't tell just when Hightower's eyes open. He sees only the mouth shut and a movement of the folded hands as Hightower sits up.
"Yes," he says. "Yes, who is—" "Oh, Byron."
Byron looks down at him, his face quite grave. But it isn't compassionate now. It isn't anything. It's just quite sober and quite determined. He says, without any inflection at all,
"They called him yesterday. I don't reckon you've heard that any more than you heard about the killing."
"Caught him?
Christmas. In Mottstown. He came to town, and near as I can learn, he stood around on the street till somebody recognized him."
"Caught him." Hightower is sitting up in the chair now.
"And you have come to tell me that he's... that they have...
No.
Ain't anybody done anything to him yet. He ain't dead yet. He's in the jail. He's all right."
"All right. You say that he is all right.
Byron says that he is all right. Byron Bunch has helped the woman's paramour sell his friend for $1,000, and Byron says that it is all right. Has kept the woman hidden from the father of her child while that, shall I say, other paramour, Byron? Shall I say that? Shall I refrain from the truth because Byron Bunch hides it?
If public talking makes truth, then I reckon that's truth. Especially when they find out that I've got both of them locked up in jail."
"Both of them?"
"Brown, too. Though I reckon most folks have about decided that Brown wasn't any more capable of doing that killing or helping in it than he was in catching the man that did do it or helping in that.
But they can all say that Byron Bunch has now got him locked up, safe in jail.
Ah, yes. Hightower's voice shakes a little, high and thin. Byron Bunch, the guardian of public weal and morality. The gainer, the inheritor of rewards, since it will now descend upon the morganatic wife of... Shall I say that, too? Shall I read Byron there, too?
Then he begins to cry, sitting huge and lax in the sagging chair.
I don't mean that. You know I don't. But it is not right to bother me, to worry me when I have taught myself to stay, have been taught by them to stay, that this should come to me, taking me after I am old and reconciled to what they deemed.
Once before, Byron saw him sit, while sweat ran down his face like tears. Now he sees the tears themselves run down the flabby cheeks like sweat. I know. It's a poor thing. Poor thing to worry you. I didn't know. I didn't know when I first got into it, or I would have... But you are a man of God. You can't dodge that.
I am not a man of God. And not through my own desire, remember that. Not of my own choice that I am no longer a man of God. It was by the will, the more than behest of them like you and like her and like him in the jail yonder and like them who put him there to do their will upon, as they did upon me, with insult and violence upon those who, like them, were created by the same God and were driven by them to do that which they now turn and rend them for having done it. It was not my choice. Remember that.
I know that. Because a man ain't given that many choices. You made your choice before that.
Hightower looks at him. You were given your choice before I was born, and you took it before I or her or him either was born. That was your choice, and I reckon them that are good must suffer for it, same as them that are bad, same as her and him and me, and the same as them others. That other woman.
That other woman. Another woman. Must my life, after 50 years, be violated and my peace destroyed by 2 lost women, Byron?
Well, this other one ain't lost now. She's been lost for 30 years, but she's found now. She's his grandmother.
Whose grandmother?
Christmas's, Byron says.
Waiting, watching the street and the gate from the dark study window, Hightower hears the distant music when it first begins. He doesn't know that he expects it, that on each Wednesday and Sunday night, sitting in the dark window, he waits for it to begin. He knows almost to the second when he should begin to hear it, without recourse to watch or clock. He uses neither. As needed neither for 25 years now. He lives dissociated from mechanical time. Yet for that reason, he's never lost it. It's as though out of his subconscious he produces without volition the few crystallizations of stated instances by which his dead life in the actual world had been governed and ordered once. Without recourse to clock, he would know immediately upon the thought just where in his old life he would be and what doing between the 2 fixed moments which marked the beginning and the end of Sunday morning service and Sunday evening service and prayer service on Wednesday night. Just when he would have been entering the church,
just when he would have been bringing to a calculated close prayer or sermon. So before twilight has completely faded, he is saying to himself, "Now they are gathering, approaching along the street slowly, and turning in, greeting one another, the groups, the couples, the single ones. There is a little informal talking in the church itself, low-toned. The ladies constant and a little sibilant with fans, nodding to arriving friends as they pass in the aisle. Miss Carruthers, she was his organist, and she's been dead almost 20 years, is among them. Soon she will rise and enter the organ loft. Sunday evening prayer meeting. It seemed to him always that at that hour man approaches nearest of all to God, nearer than at any other hour of all the 7 days. Then alone of all church gatherings is there something of that peace which is the promise and the end of the church. The mind and the heart purge then, if it's ever to be. The week, and its whatever disasters, finished and summed and expiated by the stern and formal fury of the morning service. The next week, and its whatever disasters not yet born. The heart, quiet now for a little while, beneath the cool, soft blowing of faith and hope. Sitting in the dark window, he seems to see them. Now they are gathering, entering the door. They are nearly all there now. And then he begins to say, "Now, now," leaning a little forward, and then, as though it had waited for his signal, the music begins. The organ strains come rich and resonant through the summer night, blended, sonorous, with that quality of abjectness and sublimation, as if the freed voices themselves were assuming the shapes and attitudes of crucifixions, ecstatic, solemn, and profound in gathering volume. Yet even then the music has still a quality stern and implacable, deliberate and without passion, so much as immolation, pleading, asking, for not love, not life, forbidding it to others, demanding in sonorous tones death, as though death were the boon, like all Protestant music. It was as though they who accepted it, and raised voices to praise it within praise, having been made what they were by that which the music praised and symbolized, they took revenge upon that which made them so by means of the praise itself. Listening, he seems to hear within it the apotheosis of his own history, his own land, his own environed blood, that people from which he sprang and among whom he lives, who can never take either pleasure or catastrophe or escape from either without brawling over it. Pleasure, ecstasy they can't seem to bear. Their escape from it is in violence, in drinking and fighting and praying. Catastrophe, too, the violence identical and apparently inescapable. And so why should not their religion drive them to crucifixion of themselves and one another, he thinks. It seems to him that he can hear within the music the declaration and dedication of that which they know that on the morrow they will have to do. It seems to him that the past week has rushed like a torrent, and that the week to come, which will begin tomorrow, is the abyss, and that now on the brink of cataract the stream has raised a single blended and sonorous and austere cry, not for justification, but as a dying salute before its own plunge, and not to any god, but to the doomed man in the barred cell within hearing of them and of two other churches, and in whose crucifixion they too will raise a cross. And they will do it gladly, he says in the dark window. He feels his mouth and jaw muscles tauten with something premonitory, something more terrible than laughing even. Since to pity him would be to admit self-doubt,
and to hope for and need pity themselves. They will do it gladly. Gladly. That's why it is so terrible, terrible, terrible.
Then, leaning forward, he sees three people approach and turn into the gate, in silhouette now against the street lamp among the shadows. He's already recognized Byron, and he looks at the two who follow him. A woman and a man, he knows them to be, yet save for the skirt which one of them wears, they're almost interchangeable, of a height and of a width which is twice that of ordinary man or woman, like two bears. He begins to laugh before he can prepare to stop it. If Byron just had a handkerchief about his head and earrings, he thinks, laughing and laughing, making no sound, trying to prepare to stop it in order to go to the door when Byron will knock. Byron leads them into the study. A dumpy woman in a purple dress and a plume and carrying an umbrella with a perfectly immobile face, and a man incredibly dirty and apparently incredibly old, with a tobacco-stained goat's beard and mad eyes. They enter, not with diffidence, but with something puppet-like about them, as if they were operated by clumsy springwork. The woman appears to be the more assured, or at least the more conscious, of the two of them. It's as though, for all her frozen and mechanically moved inertia, she had come for some definite purpose, or at least with some vague hope. But he sees at once that the man is in something like coma, as though oblivious and utterly indifferent to his whereabouts, and yet withal a quality latent and explosive, paradoxically rapt and alert at the same time. "This is her," Byron says quietly. "This Miss Hines." They stand there, motionless. The woman, as though she'd reached the end of a long journey, and now, among strange faces and surroundings, waits, quiet, glacier-like, like something made of stone and painted, and the calm, rapt yet latently furious and dirty old man. It's as though neither of them had so much as looked at him, with curiosity or without. He indicates chairs. Byron guides the woman, who lowers herself carefully, clutching the umbrella. The man sits at once. Hightower takes his chair beyond the desk. "What is it she wants to talk to me about?" he says. The woman doesn't move. Apparently she hasn't heard. She's like someone who's performed an arduous journey on the strength of a promise and who now ceases completely and waits. "This is him," Byron says. "This is Reverend Hightower."
"Tell him.
Tell him what you want him to know." She looks at Byron when he speaks, her face quite blank. If there is inarticulateness behind it, articulateness is nullified by the immobility of the face itself. If hope or yearning, neither hope nor yearning show.
"Tell him," Byron says. "Tell him why you came. What you came to Jefferson for."
"It was because," she says. Her voice is sudden and deep, almost harsh, though not loud. It's as though she'd not expected to make so much noise when she spoke. She ceases in a sort of astonishment, as though at the sound of her own voice, looking from one to the other of the two faces.
"Tell me," Hightower says, "try to tell me." "It's because I..."
Again the voice ceases, dies harshly, though still not raised, as though of its own astonishment. It's as if the three words were some automatic impediment which her voice can't pass.
They can almost watch her marshaling herself to go around them.
I ain't never seen him when he could walk, she says. Not for 30 years I never saw him. Never once walking on his own feet and calling his own name. Betchery, an abomination,
the man says suddenly. His voice is high, shrill, strong.
Betchery, an abomination.
Then he ceases. Out of his immediate and dreamlike state, he shouts the three words with outrageous and prophet-like suddenness, and that's all. Hightower looks at him and then at Byron. Byron says quietly, "He is their daughter's child. He," with a slight movement in the head, he indicates the old man, who's now watching Hightower with his bright, mad glare.
"He took it right after it was born and carried it away. She didn't know what he did with it. She never even knew if it was still alive or not until..."
The old man interrupts again with that startling suddenness. But he doesn't shout this time. His voice now is as calm and logical as Byron's own. He talks clearly, just a little jerkily.
"Yes. Old Doc Hines took him. God give old Doc Hines his chance, and so old Doc Hines give God his chance, too. So out of the mouths of little children, God used his will. The little children holler nigger, nigger at him in the hearing of God and man both, showing God's will. And old Doc Hines said to God, but that ain't enough. Them children call one another worse than nigger. And God said, you wait and you watch, because I ain't got the time to waste neither with this world's sluttishness and bitchery. I have put the mark on him, and now I'm going to put the knowledge. And I have set you there to watch and guard my will. It will be yours to tend to it and oversee."
His voice ceases. His tone doesn't drop at all. His voice just stops, exactly like when the needle is lifted from a phonograph record by the hand of someone who isn't listening to the record. Hightower looks from him to Byron, also almost glaring.
"What's this? What's this?" he says.
"I wanted to fix it so she could come and talk to you without him being along," Byron says. "But there wasn't anywhere to leave him. And she says she has to watch him. He was trying down in Mottstown yesterday to get the folks worked up to lynch him before he even knew what he'd done."
"Lynch him?" Hightower says. "Lynch his own grandson?"
"That's what she says," Byron says levelly.
"She says that's what he come up here for, and she had to come with him to keep him from doing it."
The woman speaks again. Perhaps she's been listening, but there's no more expression on her face now than when she entered. Wooden-faced, she speaks again in her dead voice with almost the suddenness of the man.
"For 50 years, he has been like that. For more than 50 years, but for 50 years I have suffered it. Even before we were married, he was always fighting. On the very night that Millie was born, he was locked up in jail for fighting. That's what I have bore and suffered. He said he had to fight because he's littler than most men, and so folks would try to put on him. That was his vanity and his pride. But I told him it was because the devil was in him, and that some day the devil was going to come on him and him not know it until too late. And the devil was going to say, 'You fierce Hines, I have come to collect my toll.' That's what I told him. The next day after Millie was born, and me still too weak to raise my head, and him just out of jail again, I told him so.
how right then God had given him a sign and a warning, that him being locked up in a jail on the very hour and minute of his daughter's birth was the Lord's own token that heaven never thought him fitten to raise a daughter. A sign from God above that town, he was a brakeman then on the railroad, was not doing him anything but harm. And he took it so himself then, because it was a sign. And we moved away from the town then, and after a while he got to be foreman at the sawmill, doing well because he hadn't begun then to take God's name in vain, and in pride to justify and excuse the devil that was in him. So when Lem Bush's wagon passed that night coming home from the circus and never stopped to let Millie out, and Euphius come back into the house and flung the things out of the drawer until he come to the pistol, I said, "Euphius, it's the devil. It's not Millie's safety that's quicking you now." And he said, "Devil or no devil, devil or no devil." And he hit me with his hand, and I laid across the bed and watched him. She ceases. But hers is on a falling inflection, as if the machine had run down in mid-record. Again, Hightower looks from her to Byron with that expression of glaring amazement. "That's how I heard it, too," Byron says. "It was hard for me to get it straight, too, at first. They were living at a sawmill that he was foreman of over in Arkansas. The gal was about 18 then. One night a circus passed the mill on the way to town. It was December, and there had been a lot of rain, and one of the wagons broke through a bridge close to the mill, and the men come to their house to wake him up and borrow some log tackle to get the wagon out. 'It's God's abomination of woman flesh,' the old man cries suddenly. Then his voice drops, lowers. It's as though he were merely gaining attention. He talks again rapidly, his tone plausible, vague, fanatic, speaking of himself again in the third person. "He knowed. Old Doc Hines knowed. He'd seen the woman's sign of God's abomination already on her, under her clothes. So when he went and put on his raincoat and lit the lantern and come back, she was already at the door, with a raincoat on too. And he said, 'You get on back to bed,' and she said, 'I want to go too,' and he said, 'You get on back inside that room,' and she went back, and he went down and got the big tackle from the mill and got the wagon out. Till nigh daybreak he worked, believing she had obeyed the command of the Father the Lord had given her. But he ought to knowed. He ought to knowed God's abomination of woman flesh. He should have knowed the walking shape of bitchery and abomination already stinking in God's sight. Telling old Doc Hines that knowed better that he was a Mexican, when old Doc Hines could see in his face the black curse of God Almighty. Telling him... 'What?' Hightower says. He speaks loudly, as if he had anticipated having to drown the other's voice by sheer volume. 'What is this?' 'It was a fellow with the circus,' Byron says. 'She told him that the man was a Mexican. The daughter told him when he called her. Maybe that's what the fellow told the gal. But he,' again he indicates the old man, 'knew somehow that the fellow had nigger blood. Maybe the circus folks told him, I don't know. He ain't never said how he found out. Like that never made any difference. And I reckon it didn't, after the next night.'"
The next night.
"I reckon she slipped out that night when the circus was stuck. He says she did. Anyway, he acted like it. and what he did couldn't have happened if he hadn't known and she hadn't slipped out, because the next day she went into the circus with some neighbors. He let her go because he didn't know then that she'd slipped out the night before. He didn't suspect anything even when she came out to get into the neighbor's wagon with her Sunday dress on. But he was waiting for the wagon when it came back that night, listening for it, when it came up the road and passed the house like it wasn't going to stop to let her out. And he ran out and called, and the neighbor stopped the wagon and the gal wasn't in it. The neighbor said that she'd left them on the circus lot to spend the night with another girl that lived about 6 miles away, and the neighbor wondered how Hines didn't know about it, because he said that the gal had a grip with her when she got into the wagon. Hines hadn't seen the grip, and she, this time he indicates the stone-faced woman, she may or may not be listening to what he's saying, she says it was the devil that guided him. She says he couldn't have known any more than she did where the gal was then. And yet he come into the house and got his pistol and knocked her down across the bed when she tried to stop him, and saddled his horse and rode off. And she said he took the only shortcut he could possibly have taken, choosing it in the dark out of half a dozen of them that would ever have caught up with him. And yet it wasn't any possible way that he could have known which road they'd taken. But he did. He found them like he'd known all the time just where they'd be. Like him and the man that his gal told him was a Mexican had made a date to meet there. It was like he knew. It was pitch dark, and even when he caught up with the buggy, there wasn't any way he could have told it was the one he wanted. But he rode right up behind the buggy, the first buggy he'd seen that night. He rode up on the right side of it, and he leaned down, still in the pitch dark, and without saying a word, without stopping his horse, and grabbed the man that might have been a stranger or a neighbor for all he could have known by sight or hearing. Grabbed him by one hand, and held the pistol against him with the other, and shot him dead, and brought the gal back home behind him on the horse. He left the buggy and the man both there on the road. It was raining again, too. He ceases. At once the woman begins to speak, as though she's been waiting with rigid impatience for Byron to cease. She speaks in the same dead, level tone, the two voices in monotonous strophe and antistrophe, two bodiless voices, recounting dreamily something performed in a region without dimension by people without blood. I laid across the bed, and I heard him go out. Then I heard the horse come up from the barn and past the house, already galloping. And I laid there without undressing, watching the lamp. The oil was getting low, and after a while I got up and took it back to the kitchen and filled it and cleaned the wick. Then I undressed and laid down with the lamp burning. It was still raining, and it was cold, too, and after a while I heard the horse come back into the yard and stop at the porch, and I got up and put on my shawl, and I heard them come into the house. I could hear Euphius's feet, and then Millie's feet, and they come on down the hall to the door, and Millie stood there with the rain on her face, and her hair, and a new dress, all muddy, and her eyes shut. And then Euphius hit her, and she fell to the floor and lay there, and she didn't look any different in the face than when she was standing up. And Euphius, standing in the door, wet and muddy too, and he said, "You said I was at the devil's work. Well, I have brought you back the devil's laid-by crop. Ask her what she's toting now inside her. Ask her." And I was that tired, and it was cold, and I said, "What happened?" And he said, "Go back yonder and look down in the mud, and you'll see." He might have fooled her that he was a Mexican, but he never fooled me. And he never fooled her. He never had to. because you said once that someday the devil would come down on me for his toll. Well, he has. My wife has borne me a whore, but at least he done what he could when the time come to collect. He showed me the right road, and he held the pistol steady. And so sometimes I would think how the devil had conquered God because we found out Millie was going to have a child, and Euphius started out to find a doctor that would fix it. I believed that he would find one, and sometimes I thought it would be better so if human man and woman was to live in the world. And sometimes I hoped he would, me being that tired and all, when the trial was over and the circus owner come back and said how the man really was a part nigger instead of Mexican, like Euphius said all the time he was, like the devil had told Euphius he was a nigger. And Euphius would take the pistol again and say he would find a doctor or kill one, and he would go away and be gone a week at a time, and all the folks knowing it, and me trying to get Euphius to let's move away, because it was just that circus man that said he was a nigger, and maybe he never knew for certain. And besides, he was gone too, and we likely wouldn't ever see him again. But Euphius wouldn't move, and Millie's time coming, and Euphius with that pistol trying to find a doctor that would do it. And then I heard how he was in jail again, how he'd been going to church and to prayer meeting at the different places where he'd been trying to find a doctor, and how one night he got up during prayer meeting and went to the pulpit and begun to preach himself, yelling against niggers for the white folks to turn out and kill them all. And the folks in the church made him quit and come down from the pulpit, and he threatened them with the pistol there in the church, until the law came and arrested him and him like a crazy man for a while. And they found out how he had beat up a doctor in another town and run away before they could catch him. So when he got out of jail and got back home, Millie's time was about on her. And I thought then that he'd give up. Had seen God's will at last, because he is quiet about the house. And one day he found the clothes me and Millie had been getting ready and kept hid from him, and he never said nothing except to ask when it would be. Every day he would ask, and we thought that he'd give up, that maybe going to them churches or being in jail again had reconciled him like it had on that night when Millie was born. And so the time come, and one night Millie waked me and told me it had started. And I dressed and told Euphius to go for the doctor, and he dressed and went out. And I got everything ready, and we waited, and the time when Euphius and the doctor should have got back come and passed, and Euphius wasn't back neither. And I waited until the doctor would have to get there pretty soon. Then I went out to the front porch to look, and I saw Euphius sitting on the top step with the shotgun across his lap, and he said, "Get back into that house, whore's damn." And I said, "Euphius." And he raised the shotgun and said, "Get back into that house. Let the devil gather his own crop. He was the one that laid it by." And I tried to get out the back way, and he hurried me and run around the house with the gun, and he hit me with the barrel of it. And I went back to Millie, and he stood outside the hall door where he could see Millie until she died. And then he come into the bed and looked at the baby, and he picked it up and held it up higher than the lamp, like he was waiting to see if the devil or the Lord would win. And I was that tired, sitting by the bed, looking at his shadow on the wall, and the shadow of his arms and the bundle high up on the wall. And then I thought that the Lord had won. But now I don't know. Because he laid the baby back on the bed by Millie and he went out. I heard him go out the front door, and then I got up and built up the fire in the stove and heated some milk.
She ceases. Her harsh, droning voice dies. Across the desk, Hightower watches her, the still, stone-faced woman in the purple dress, who hasn't moved since she entered the room. Then she begins to speak again, without moving, almost without lip movement, as if she were a puppet, and the voice that of a ventriloquist in the next room. And Euphius was gone. The man that owned the mill didn't know where he'd gone to. He got a new foreman. But he let me stay in the house a while longer because we didn't know where Euphius was, and it coming winter, and me with the baby to take care of. And I didn't know where Euphius was any more than Mr. Gilman did, until the letter came. It was from Memphis, and it had a post office money paper in it, and that was all. So I still didn't know. And then in November, another money paper came without any letter or anything. And I was that tired. Then 2 days before Christmas, I was out in the backyard chopping wood. And I come back into the house, and the baby was gone. I hadn't been out of the house an hour, and it looked like I could have seen him when he come and went. But I didn't. I just found the letter where Euphius had left it on the pillow that I would put between the baby and the edge of the bed so he couldn't roll off. And I was that tired. And I waited. And after Christmas, Euphius come home. And he wouldn't tell me. He just said that we were going to move. And I thought that he'd already took the baby there and he'd come back for me. And he wouldn't tell me where we were going to move to, but it didn't take long, and I was worried not crazy how the baby would get along until we got there, and he still wouldn't tell me, and it was like we would never get there. Then we got there, and the baby wasn't there, and I said, "You tell me what you have done with Joey. You got to tell me." And he looked at me like he looked at Millie that night when she laid on the bed and died. And he said, "It's the Lord God's abomination, and I am the instrument of his will." And he went away the next day, and I didn't know where he'd gone. And another money paper came. And the next month, Euphius come home and said he was working in Memphis. And I knew he had Joey hid somewhere in Memphis. And I thought that that was something, because he could be there to see to Joey even if I wasn't. And I knew that I would have to wait on Euphius's will to know. And each time I would think that maybe next time he will take me with him to Memphis. And so I waited. I sewed and made clothes for Joey. And I would have him all ready when Euphius would come home, and I would try to get him to tell me if the clothes fit Joey, and if he is all right. And Euphius wouldn't tell me. He would sit and read out of the Bible, loud, without nobody there to hear it but me, reading and hollering loud out of the Bible like he believed I didn't believe what it said. But he wouldn't tell me for 5 years. And I never knew whether he took Joey the clothes I made or not. And I was afraid to ask, to worry at him, because it was something that he was there where Joey was, even if I wasn't. And then after 5 years, he came home one day and he said, "We're going to move." And I thought that now it would be. I'll see him again now. If it was a sin, I reckon we've all paid it out now. And I even forgave Euphius, because I thought that we were going to Memphis this time at last. But it wasn't to Memphis. We come to Mottstown. We had to pass through Memphis, and I begged him. It was the first time I'd ever begged him, but I did then, just for a minute, a second.
not to touch him or talk to him or nothing. But Euphius wouldn't. We never even left the depot. We got off of one train and we waited 7 hours without even leaving the depot until the other train come. And we come to Mottstown. And Euphius never went back to Memphis to work anymore. And after a while I said, Euphius? And he looked at me and I said, I done waited 5 years and I ain't never bothered you. Can't you tell me just once if he's dead or not? And he said, he is dead. And I said, dead to the living world or just dead to me? If he is just dead to me even, tell me that much, because in 5 years I've not bothered you. And he said, he is dead to you and to me and to God and to all God's world forever and evermore.
This ends Disc 12.
She ceases again. Beyond the desk, Hightower watches her with that quiet and desperate amazement. Byron, too, is motionless, his head bent a little. The three of them are like three rocks above a beach, above ebb tide, save the old man. He's been listening now, almost attentively, with that ability of his to flux instantaneously between complete attention that doesn't seem to hear, and that coma-like bemusement in which the stare of his apparently inverted eye is as uncomfortable as though he held them with his hand. He cackles, suddenly bright, loud, mad. He speaks, incredibly old, incredibly dirty.
It was the Lord. He was there. Old Doc Hines give God his chance too. The Lord told old Doc Hines what to do, and old Doc Hines done it. And then the Lord said to old Doc Hines, you watch now. Watch my will awakening. And old Doc Hines watched and hurried the mouths of little children, of God's own fatherless and motherless, putting his words and knowledge into their mouths, even when they couldn't know it, since they were without sin yet, even the girl ones without sin and bitchery yet. Nigger. Nigger in the innocent mouths of little children. What did I tell you? God said to old Doc Hines. And now I set my will to working, and now I'm gone. There ain't enough sin here to keep me busy, because what do I care for the fornications of a slut, since that is a part of my purpose too. And old Doc Hines said, how is the fornications of a slut a part of your purpose too? And God said, you wait and see. You think it's just chance, so, that I sent that young doctor to be the one that found my abomination laying wrapped in that blanket on that doorstep that Christmas night? You think it was just chance, so, that the madam should have been away that night and give them young sluts a chance and call to name him Christmas in sacrilege of my son? So I am gone now, because I have set my will a-working, and I can leave you here to watch it. So old Doc Hines, he watched and he waited. From God's own boiler room he watched them children, and the devil's walking seed unbeknownst among them, polluting the earth with the working of that word upon him, because he didn't play with the other children no more now. He stayed by himself, standing still. And then old Doc Hines knew that he was listening to the hidden warning of God's doom. And old Doc Hines said to him, won't you play with them other children like you used to? And he didn't say nothing. And old Doc Hines said, is it because they call you nigger? And he didn't say nothing. And old Doc Hines said, do you think you are a nigger because God has marked your face? And he said, is God a nigger too? And old Doc Hines said, "He is the Lord God of wrathful hosts. His will be done, not yours and not mine, because you and me are both a part of his purpose and his vengeance." And he went away. And old Doc Hines watched him, hearing and listening to the vengeful will of the Lord, until old Doc Hines found out how he was watching the nigger working in the yard, following him around the yard while he worked, until at last the nigger said, "What you watching me for, boy?" And he said, "How come you're a nigger?"
And the nigger said, "Who told you I'm a nigger, you little white trash bastard?" And he says, "I ain't a nigger." And the nigger says, "You're worse than that. You don't know what you are, and more than that, you won't ever know. You'll live and you'll die, and you won't never know." And he says, "God ain't no nigger." And the nigger says, "I reckon you ought to know what God is, because don't nobody but God know what you is." But God wasn't there to say, because he had set his will to working and left old Doc Hines to watch it. From that very first night when he chose his own son's sacred anniversary to set it a working on, he set old Doc Hines to watch it. It was cold that night, and old Doc Hines, standing in the dark just behind the corner where he could see the doorstep and the accomplishment of the Lord's will, and he saw that young doctor coming in lechery and fornication, stop and stoop down and raise the Lord's abomination and tote it into the house. And old Doc Hines, he followed, and he seen and heard. He watched them young sluts that was desecrating the Lord's sacred anniversary with eggnog and whiskey in the madam's absence open the blanket. And it was her, the Jezebel of the doctor, that was the Lord's instrument that said, "We'll name him Christmas." And another one said, "What Christmas? Christmas what?" And God said to old Doc Hines, "Tell him." And they all looked at old Doc Hines with the reek of pollution on them, hollering, "Why, it's Uncle Doc. Look what Santa Claus brought us and left on the doorstep, Uncle Doc." And old Doc Hines said, "His name is Joseph." And they quit laughing. And they looked at old Doc Hines, and the Jezebel said, "How do you know?" And old Doc Hines said, "The Lord says so." And then they laughed again, hollering, "It is so in the book. Christmas, the son of Joe. Joe, the son of Joe. Joe Christmas," they said. "To Joe Christmas." And they tried to make old Doc Hines drink too, to the Lord's abomination, but he struck the cup aside. And he just had to watch and to wait. And he did. And it was in the Lord's good time for evil to come from evil. And the doctor's Jezebel come running from her lustful bed, still astink with sin and fear. "He was hid behind the bed," she says. And old Doc Hines said, "You used that perfume soap that tempted your undoing for the Lord's abomination and outrage. Suffer it." And she said, "You can talk to him. I've seen you. You could persuade him." And old Doc Hines said, "I care no more for your fornications than God does." And she said, "He will tell, and I'll be fired. I'll be disgraced." Stinking with her lust and lechery, she was then standing before old Doc Hines with the working of God's will on her at that minute, who had outraged the house where God housed his fatherless and motherless. "You ain't nothing," old Doc Hines said. "You and all sluts, you are an instrument of God's wrathful purpose, that ne'er a sparrow can fall to earth. You are an instrument of God, the same as Joe Christmas and old Doc Hines." And she went away, and old Doc Hines, he waited and he watched, and it wasn't long before she come back, and her face was like the face of a ravening beast of the desert. "I fixed him," she said. and old Doc Hines said Hal fixed him. Because it wasn't anything that old Doc Hines didn't know, because the Lord didn't keep his purpose hid from his chosen instrument. And old Doc Hines said, "You have served the foreordained will of God. You can go now and abominate him in peace until the day." And her face looked like the ravening beast of the desert, laughing out of her rotten-colored dirt at God. And they come and took him away. Old Doc Hines saw him go away in the buggy. And he went back to wait for God. And God come, and he said to old Doc Hines, "You can go too now. You have done my work. There is no more evil here now but woman evil, not worthy for my chosen instrument to watch." And old Doc Hines went when God told him to go. But he kept in touch with God, and at night he said, "That bastard, Lord." And God said, "He is still walking my earth." And old Doc Hines kept in touch with God, and at night he said, "That bastard, Lord." And God said, "He's still walking my earth." And old Doc Hines kept in touch with God, and one night he wrestled and he strove and he cried aloud, "That bastard, Lord, I feel the teeth and the fangs of evil." And God said, "It's that bastard. Your work is not done yet. He's a pollution and an abomination on my earth." The sound of music from the distant church has long since ceased. Through the open window there comes now only the peaceful and myriad sounds of the summer night. Beyond the desk, Hightower sits, looking more than ever like an awkward beast, tricked and befooled of the need for flight, brought now to bay by those who tricked and fooled it. The other three sit facing him, almost like a jury. Two of them are also motionless, the woman with that stone-visaged patience of a waiting rock, the old man with a spent quality, like the charred wick of a candle from which the flame has been violently blown away. Byron alone seems to possess life. His face is lowered. He seems to muse upon one hand which lies upon his lap, the thumb and forefinger of which rub slowly together with a kneading motion, while he appears to watch with musing absorption. When Hightower speaks, Byron knows that he isn't addressing him, not addressing anyone in the room at all. "What do they want me to do?" he says. "What do they think, hope, believe that I can do?" Then there's no sound. Neither the man nor the woman have heard, apparently. Byron doesn't expect the man to hear. He don't need any help, he thinks. Not him. It's hindrance that he needs. Thinking, remembering the coma state of dreamy yet maniacal suspension in which the old man had moved from place to place, a little behind the woman since he'd met them 12 hours ago. It's hindrance he needs. I reckon it's a good thing for more folks than her that he's well nigh helpless. He's watching the woman. He says quietly, almost gently, "Go on. Tell him what you want." He wants to know what you want him to do. Tell him. "I thought maybe," she says. She speaks without stirring. Her voice isn't tentative so much as rusty, as if it were being forced to try to say something outside the province of being said aloud, of being anything save felt, known. "Mr. Bunch said that maybe..." "What?" Hightower says. He speaks sharply, impatiently, his voice a little high. He, too, hasn't moved, sitting back in the chair, his hands upon the armrests. What? That what? I thought... The voice dies again. Beyond the window, the steady insects whir. Then the voice goes on, flat, toneless. She's sitting also with her head bent a little, as if she too listened to the voice with the same quiet intentness. He is my grandson, my girl's little boy. I just thought that if he... Byron listens quietly, thinking, it's right funny. You'd think they done got swapped somewhere, like it was him that had a nigger grandson waiting to be hung. The voice goes on. I know it ain't right to bother a stranger, but you are lucky. A bachelor, a single man that could grow old without the despair of love. But I reckon you couldn't ever see it even if I could tell it right. I just thought that maybe if it could be for one day like it hadn't happened, like folks never knew him as a man that had killed. The voice ceases again. She hasn't stirred. It's as though she listened to it cease, as she listened to it begin with the same interest, the same quiet unastonishment. Go on, Hightower says in that high, impatient voice. Go on. I never saw him when he could walk and talk. Not for 30 years I never saw him. I'm not saying he never did what they say he did. Ought not to suffer for it, like he made them that loved and lost suffer. But if folks could maybe just let him for one day, like it hadn't happened yet, like the world never had anything against him yet, then it could be like he just went on a trip and grew man-grown and come back. If it could be like that for just one day. After that, I wouldn't interfere. If he done it, I wouldn't be the one to come between him and what he must suffer. Just for one day, you see. Like he'd been on a trip and come back telling me about the trip without any living earth against him yet. Oh, Hightower says in his shrill, high voice, though he hasn't moved, though the knuckles of the hands which grip the chair arms are taut and white, there begins to emerge from beneath his clothing a slow and repressed quivering. Ah, yes, he says, that's all, that's simple, simple, simple. Apparently he can't stop saying it. Simple, simple. He's been speaking in a low tone. Now his voice rises. What is it they want me to do? What must I do now? Byron? Byron, what is it? What are they asking of me now? Byron has risen. He now stands beside the desk, his hands on the desk, facing Hightower. Still, Hightower doesn't move, save for that steadily increasing quivering of his flabby body. Ah, yes, I should have known. It will be Byron who will ask it, I should have known. That will be reserved for Byron and for me. Come, come, out with it. Why do you hesitate now? Byron looks down at the desk, his hands upon the desk. It's a poor thing. A poor thing. Ah! Commiseration. After this long time, a commiseration for me or for Byron. Come, out with it. What do you want me to do? For it is you, I know that. I've known that all along. Ah, Byron, Byron, what a dramatist you would have made. Or maybe you mean a drummer. an agent, a salesman, Byron says. It's a poor thing, I know that. You don't need to tell me. But I am not clairvoyant like you. You seem to know already what I could tell you, and yet you will not tell me what you intend for me to know. What is it you want me to do? Shall I go plead guilty to the murder? Is that it?
Byron's face cracks with that grimace, faint, fleeting, sardonic, weary, without mirth. It's next to that, I reckon. Then his face sobers. It's quite grave. It's a poor thing to ask. God knows I know that. He watches his slow hand where it moves, preoccupied and trivial, upon the desktop. I mind how I said to you once that there's a price for being good, same as for being bad, a cost to pay. And it's a good man that can't deny the bill when it comes around. They can't deny it for the reason that there ain't any way to make 'em pay it. They're like an honest man that gambles. The bad men can deny it. That's why don't anybody expect them to pay on sight or any other time. But the good can. Maybe it takes longer to pay for being good than for being bad. And it won't be like you haven't done it before, haven't already paid a bill like it once before. It oughtn't to be so bad now as it was then. Go on. Go on. What is it I am to do? Byron watches his slow and ceaseless hand, musing. He ain't never admitted that he killed her. And all the evidence they got against him is Brown's word, which is next to none. You could say he was here with you that night. Yeah, every night. When Brown said he watched him go up to the big house and go in it. Folks would believe you. They would believe that anyway. They would rather believe that about you than to believe that he lived with her like a husband and then killed her. And you're old now. They wouldn't do anything to you about it that would hurt you now. And I reckon you're used to everything else they can do.
Oh. Hightower says. Ah, yes, yes, they would believe it. That would be very simple, very good. Good for all. Then he will be restored to them who have suffered because of him. And Brown, without the reward, could be scared into making her child legitimate, and then into fleeing again, and forever this time. And then it would be just her and Byron. Since I am just an old man who has been fortunate enough to grow old without having to learn the despair of love. He's shaking, steadily. He looks up now. In the lamplight his face looks slick, as if it had been oiled. Wrung and twisted it gleams in the lamplight. The yellowed, oft-washed shirt, which was fresh this morning, is damp with sweat. It's not because I can't. Don't dare to, he says. It's because I won't. I won't, do you hear? He raises his hands from the chair arms. It's because I won't do it. Byron doesn't move. His hand on the desktop has ceased. He watches the other, thinking, it ain't me he's shouting at. It's like he knows there's something nearer him than me to convince of that. Because now Hightower is shouting, I won't do it! I won't! With his hands raised and clenched, his face sweating, his lip lifted upon his clenched and rotting teeth, from about which the long sagging of flabby and putty-colored flesh falls away. Suddenly his voice rises higher yet. Get out! He screams.
Get out of my house! Get out of my house!
Then he falls forward onto the desk, his face between his extended arms and his clenched fists. As the two old people moving ahead of him, Byron looks back from the door. He sees that Hightower hasn't moved. His bald head and his extended and clenched-fisted arms lying full in the pool of light from the shaded lamp. Beyond the open window, the sound of insects hasn't ceased, not faltered.